Part 2 American History, Uncensored King George's Historic Claim to Ownership of the 13 American Colonies called, the Virginia Colony was a prevarication, which was manipulated by the Rothschild faction. America was already inhabited by the Red Race, the actual descendants of Atlantis, a continent destroyed around 9600 BC during a worldwide continental land shift. The Emperor of America was an Indian named Moitoi. In order for King George to lawfully lay claim to America, it was absolutely necessary for England to conquer the Red Race first, or the king would have had to negotiate with and procure land grants from the Red Race. This was virtually impossible, and therefore King George's land grants issued for the American colonies was a complete fraud and was contrary to an ancient international treaty titled, the Ancient Rights of Discovery. The Ancient Rights of Discovery defined that only new, uninhabited, or conquered lands could be claimed by a sovereign king or by his discoverer on his behalf, and so representatives of the Virginia Colony negotiated a territorial treaty with eastern tribes of the Red Race, which King George used as his base authority to issue his bogus land grants. Factually, land grants could never have been obtained from the American Indian, because the Red Race culture believed that no man can own the wind or the sun any more than he can own the land, which the gods have created for their use and benefit, and since the Red Race was more than capable of repelling any armada sent against them by any of the superpowers of that time, the king and the pope deduced that their demise would need to be accomplished by other means. The Red Race were gracious hosts and landlords and were willing to share what they had with the white immigrants, a disposition they would eventually regret for an eternity. Columbus factually never set foot on American soil, but rather sailed south from Spain to the island of Haiti, while seeking a new trade route to China. On the island of Haiti, Columbus and his crew 25 murdered all of the original inhabitants so that he could claim the island for Spain, pursuant to the ancient rights of discovery, and he renamed the island America. Columbus later repopulated Haiti with captured slaves from Africa. Columbus was Catholic, a blue-bearded pirate in his own right, and was far from a Christian or hero by any stretch of the imagination. The result of this mishap eventually led the sovereign king of Spain to believe that he too held a valid claim to the new continent now known by all as North America. Note: Spain fraudulently claimed that Columbus discovered Louisiana and had claimed it for the king, and subsequently the Vatican used its influence to make Columbus a Christian hero, to help promote Catholicism in America. The Pilgrims were a persecuted and exiled religious order originating in England, and upon their exile they migrated to and lived in Holland for 2 years before traveling to America, but not on Spanish or English ships, but rather on Dutch ships named the Mayflower and the Speedwell. The Speedwell was sabotaged by the crew because they were tired of the long voyage and the remaining voyage to the Virginia colony. Their sabotage forced both ships to land farther north in Plymouth Harbor. Iroquois Nation. The Pilgrims were greeted by the Iroquois Indian Nation when they anchored at Plymouth Harbor. The Iroquois Federation government consented to permit the Pilgrims to cohabitate with them, providing that they first experience life as an Indian and complied with their Federation government rules, such as, no one can own the land, a prohibition against slavery, no theft of another man's property, and no persecution for religious beliefs, i.e. freedom of religion. Do any of these sound familiar? 26. Note: Even George Washington would eventually be required to cohabitate with the Iroquois Indians before being granted leave to remain on American soil. George Washington was supposed to negotiate a treaty with the Red Race, which would amount to approximately 568 separate tribes. Washington wanted to avoid this and requested to meet with the emperor, but Moitoi refused to grant Washington an audience because he was a commoner and not an emperor in his own right. The eastern tribes received permission from their emperor to negotiate separate treaties with these white immigrants, if they so choose. I.e. Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, Tennessee, and five other states are located in the Cherokee Indian Nation territory per the Treaty of 1791, and it is still valid and enforceable. The Iroquois Federation government and their constitution was a carryover from when the Red Race were Atlanteans and the dominate civilization of the earth. The Red Race made one huge mistake in their dealings with these white immigrants. They had become complacent and believed they were always in control and were undefeatable. A lot of fights began to break out between the various tribes, which usually involved some form of bias and prejudice in order to establish superiority over the other neighboring tribes, a human flaw that has constantly occurred since ancient Babylon and continues to occur in this day and age. During these tribal distractions, the colonists would break many of the strict rules that bound them, and the red race continued to ignore these minor violations and nuances of their federation government. The red race considered these white immigrants to be an inoffensive, physically weak, uneducated, and slow-witted group, and so they generally chose to ignore their minor breaches of the rules. The white immigrants, however, weren't as ignorant as was believed, because every minor breach was intended to chip away at the strict rules the red race had established for them and therein establish their own superiority over the Indian tribes. Many of the pilgrim women chose to remain with and marry Indian braves because of how favorably women were treated by the red race, which has always been an historic distortion of fact created by the white men and their government leaders, to justify their 27 attacks and theft of the North American continent and their attempted extinction of the red race. For numerous years to follow, many of the white colonial women, who were supposedly rescued from their captivity, escaped from their white liberators, only to return to their Indian husbands. This happened so frequently and became such an embarrassment to the white colonial men that they established and introduced standards of conduct and behavior for women, and violators were frequently ostracized by the white community. The white men, however, were never held to the same standards as the women. Equal rights would take over 200 more years to evolve in America. The Iroquois Federation government, their constitution, and even their postal system, was eventually copied by the Founding Fathers, the Continental Congress, and every European government. The UPU, Universal Postal Union, is a direct product of the Iroquois Federation postal system. These concepts, however, were slightly modified by the white race to define money, generate money, to permit control and ownership of land and license personal and intellectual property, which has always been a part of the white race's culture, idealism, and their preoccupation to own and control people, places, and things. The Puritans are responsible for having hand-delivered and educated Europe in the Iroquois Federation doctrines after they migrated back to England, upon the removal of Oliver Cromwell from the throne of England. Note: our history books teach us that the Founding Fathers claimed these doctrines to be the fruit of their intellect and invention, and those same historians actually had the nerve to identify the red race as the savages. The fact of the matter is that many of the Founding Fathers were usually stoned on hemp or drunk on rum and were not capable of concocting anything as rational and complex as a constitution or declaration of independence. Many of the Founding Fathers were from a privileged class who frequently partied with prostitutes and cheating wives and secret sex societies. As far as the Indian being a savage, think about it: if someone kept breaking his word and stole from you, you might begin to behave savagely too. 28. The colonization of America continued to expand while King George grew deeper in debt to the Rothschild Bank. It was Mayor Emshel Bauer, a Sabbatan Jew and the founder of the Rothschild banking empire, who suggested to King George that he tax the American colonies and demand his payment in gold. Since he was thoroughly in debt to the Rothschild Bank, King George subsequently decided to follow Mr. Bauer's advice to tax all commerce entering or exiting the Americas, and he demanded his payment in gold. His first tax was on tea. The colonists did not trade in gold but had developed a system of exchange based upon promissory notes called colonial script, which is similar to the Federal Reserve notes of today. The difference between colonial script and Federal Reserve notes is consent. The colonists consented to establish and honor the colonial script as a fair medium of exchange and which bore no interest charges, whereas Federal Reserve notes were thrust upon Americans by the Rothschild royal family, without our consent, with interest, and the intent of stealing the fruits of American labor, equity, and assets. The king's demand for gold is what instigated the Boston Tea Party and not the historic claim of taxation without representation. The colonists were actually willing to pay King George's tea tax, providing he would accept his payment in colonial script, which he could then trade back to them for tobacco and hemp products, and he refused. In response to the Boston Tea Party, King George sent his military in force to intimidate the colonists. This resulted in an armed confrontation and many skirmishes, which was later billed and classified as the Revolutionary War. the 51 colonists who are counted as being the founding fathers, prepared and served a declaration upon King George, declaring America's independence from England under the name of the United States of America, which did not set well with the king. In fact, it outraged him. The colonists learned to fight guerrilla-style warfare from fighting with and against the various Indian tribes and subsequently won many of these revolutionary skirmishes, but they never had a prayer of winning a war, and besides, King George never intended to kill off 29 the colonists because, who then would pay his tax? All he was attempting to do was regain control over his deposed slaves and any new slaves who had joined forces with the colonists. Another historic fact that has been concealed from our history is that the first and foremost crop to be grown in America was hemp or marijuana. America got its commercial start from a plant that is now classified a Schedule I drug. Each of the founding fathers owned large hemp plantations. The colonists made rope, flags, homespun clothing, sails, writing paper and medicine from the processed hemp, and the sterilized seed was used in baking, called sesame seeds. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are actually written on hemp paper. The introduction of tobacco eventually changed the score because tobacco was so naturally addictive that England couldn't get enough of it and purchased all the colonists could grow. Tobacco sold for more money than hemp, however, hemp had more practical uses. Many colonial farmers split their land into two, half hemp and half tobacco, whereas others changed over to all tobacco. All of the colonists grew corn, potatoes, squash, apples, cabbage and raised chickens, beef and dairy cattle, and sheep, but that was for their own personal consumption and not for export. England had just defeated Napoleon and the English soldiers were battle-weary. Most of the English soldiers refused to fight the American colonists because so many of the colonists were their relatives. So Mr. Bauer traveled to Prussia and engaged the services of unemployed Hessian mercenaries for the career English officers to command. The Hessian soldiers had just finished fighting the Seven Years' War and there was little need or employment for career soldiers. Their contract pay with Bauer was for 50 cents a day and Mr. Bauer billed the king for $1 a day. Since King George had a revolving charge with the Rothschild Bank, repayment for these soldiers would eventually be required of him in gold. Moral: never trust a banker or a Sabbatan Jew. 30 Mayor Amschel, Bauer, Rothschild. Upon defeating the French, a second suggestion was presented to King George by Mr. Bauer, which was for the king to arrange through his newly appointed civilian administrator of France, to offer the Continental Congress a loan and appropriations to supply and finance the Revolutionary War. George's plan and logic was simple: to bring America to its knees in debt and then foreclose on it. Unfortunately, colonial America didn't have a prayer of winning, and most of the money and appropriations loaned or sold to them went into the pockets of the members of the Founding Fathers. King George now controlled England, Ireland, and France and ruled over roughly 60 million subjects. He also possessed the largest and most efficient military force known at that time, which was the combined army and navy of France and England. The American colony known as the Virginia Colony was populated by 3 million men, women, and children in total, and most of the men were farmers and tradesmen or bond slaves, armed only with knives and flintlock muskets. So it is beyond imagination that anyone could possibly believe that the American colonists ever won or possessed a chance of winning the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. But then, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will begin to believe you. Nobody won the Revolutionary War, but since the English military was first to stop fighting, the Continental Congress declared that America won the war, based upon an old maxim of law, which reads, "He who leaves the field of battle first loses." 31-20 members of the Continental Congress were formerly founding fathers and were once English lawyers and aristocrats who had received considerable training in the art of English law, and they thought up that little jewel. Need I say more? This situation, however, posed a new problem for the Continental Congress to resolve, which was how to place their debt to France on the backs of the American colonists. They decided to tax all alcoholic beverages, which was the impetus that started the American moonshine business and rum smuggling trade. One of the largest rum smugglers in America was Founding Father, John Hancock. Mr. Bauer also had an ulterior motive apart from collecting the king's debt to his bank in gold. Bauer viewed the American colonies as an untapped resource and a prime location to establish another branch of his Rothschild bank. His plan was simple: to establish a branch of his banking empire in the colonies, replace the colonial script with his corporate bank script, and then extend unlimited credit to the colonists with a repayment in gold. It worked on King George, so why shouldn't it work in the American colonies? Bauer also changed his last name to Rothschild around this time frame. Note: the colonists never knew that the state of Virginia was as rich in gold deposits as the state of California and the Dakotas, and that this little piece of information was kept secret from the public for a very good reason. The high contracting powers wanted to expand the Virginia colonies to the west coast of America and defeat the Red Race at the same time, and so the California Gold Rush rumor was created by the American government. It was a rumor that was spread around the world in order to entice immigration and to replace the immigrants who died during their westward migration. Rothschild, however, was unsuccessful in accomplishing his plan for the American colony because the Continental Congress rejected his proposal based in part on a business plan they were drafting or modifying that was designed to ensure and protect their individual interests, titled "The Constitution of the United States of America," which was a modified version of the Iroquois Federation Government Constitution. The Articles of Confederation was the 32 outline for the Constitution, and which spelled out their business plan to control America. The colonists were never asked if they wanted a constitution, nor were they asked to vote on this document, because the Continental Congress had always intended to steal North America for their own personal posterity. The term "we the people" was actually defined to mean "we the delegates" by the Articles of Confederation, but we Americans were never told that little piece of information. The safeguards found in the Constitution were not for our protection, but were actually intended to prevent any one or group of founding fathers from cutting the others out, which is conclusive proof in support of the old proverb, which reads, "There is no honor among thieves." While Mr. Rothschild openly condemned the use of colonial script as money by calling it worthless, his agents and employees who had secretly infiltrated the American colonies were instructed to buy up or trade for all available script that they could lay their hands on. While this was going on, Rothschild sent his top banking agent in Europe to further infiltrate the new American government, a man by the name of Alexander Levine. Once in America, Mr. Levine changed his last name to Hamilton, to obscure his Sabaudan Jewish ancestry and conceal any connection as the CFO of the Rothschild banking empire. Alexander Hamilton secured employment as the personal secretary to General George Washington, and after Washington's election to the office of president, Alexander Hamilton was appointed by President Washington as the first United States Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton, however, always remained loyal to the Rothschild family and the Rothschild Bank, and as the first United States Secretary of the Treasury, he manipulated the value of the colonial script that the Rothschild agents had accumulated and drafted a proposed charter for the first United States Central Bank with a 20-year contract. President George Washington signed the Central Bank Charter into law and therein successfully entered the Rothschild banking empire into American commerce, by the stroke of a pen. 33 Note: our public education in American history taught us to laud Alexander Hamilton as a great American hero and patriot, when all along he was just another one of the many traitors to America who helped to undermine the Republic and the new American government. When the Founding Fathers rejected the Rothschilds' request for another 20-year charter, in a fit of rage and with King George's help, Nathan Rothschild, who was in charge of the London branch, provoked and personally financed the entire cost of the War of 1812. During the War of 1812, King George deduced that if he destroyed the American symbol of government and eliminated specific signers of the Declaration of Independence, whom he deemed to be the troublemakers, called patriots and loyalists, and burned the actual Declaration of Independence, that those acts of force and violence should take the fight out of the American colonists and they would succumb to he and Nathan Rothschild's plans. 30 of the 51 signers of the Declaration of Independence were loyal Americans, and the other 21 were traitors and were secretly loyal to King George. We laud these 21 traitors as heroes and patriots of the American Revolution because our government has taught us to do so, but never a word has been written, spoken, or taught about the other 30 loyalists who gave their last full measure of devotion in our cause of liberty. Don't you find that just a little suspicious? After the White House in Philadelphia was burned and specific American loyalists, their entire families and relatives were murdered and burned in their homes in order to eliminate them as martyrs, the fighting stopped. The colonists returned to their trades and the English military took up quarters in New Amsterdam, now New York, for the next 8 years before returning to England and the Continental Congress once again declared America the victors. Prior to the War of 1812, Benjamin Franklin made numerous trips to England supposedly to visit an English woman and love interest. However, colonial documents suggest that Franklin was a common participant in the sex parties held by the wealthy, so why travel to England to visit a love interest? Can anyone explain why Franklin 34 died a bachelor and how the British military possessed the names and addresses of all 30 Loyalist family members and their relatives with specific directions to the homes of all 30 patriots on the King's death list? Ironically, the other 21 founding fathers and their families were never harmed or threatened. The Treaty of Paris/K/A. The Treaty of Peace was negotiated by Franklin, Adams, and Jay. In the Treaty of Paris was the concession that King George's son, Prince William, was to be the sovereign ruler of America. I might also point out that around this time, Benjamin Franklin became the first Postmaster General, John Jay became the first Supreme Court Chief Justice, and Samuel Adams served as Vice President under George Washington, for two terms before being elected as the second President of the United States. Were those positions appointed or arranged for based upon merit, or were they actually rewards from a grateful king? Remember the constitutional amendment regarding the separation of church and state. Well, it may very well have been added and adopted by the founding fathers because of the great historic influence continually wielded by the Pope and the Church of Rome. The founding fathers were planning to steal America for themselves, so it would only make sense that such a prohibition and amendment be incorporated into their business plan, Constitution, to avoid an open confrontation with the Pope and the Church of Rome. If the Holy Roman Church eventually infiltrated America, the Pope would then be prohibited from involving the Church in the business of the new government. George Washington, the first American president and the epitomized father of this country, had his own plan in mind: to be anointed King of America, and after his election, George overthrew the organic Constitution for the United States of America under the Articles of Confederation and reinstated the Virginia Colony Corporation, and thereafter eliminated the first constitutional civilian government on April 30, 1789. George had a law background and relied upon the Articles of Confederation to perform his treasonous plot, and then he immediately took office 1 year before the Organic Constitution 35 would have lawfully permitted him to do so. George died at the age of 67 in 1799 Virginia, and his only rightful claim to fame is treason, and that he initiated a legacy of military dictatorships called the American Presidency. Few Americans understand the kind of man George Washington really was, and it is highly doubtful that George ever told the truth. George is a hero in the eyes of the corporate state and federal government politicians, but he was actually an opportunist, a liar, a tyrant, and a traitor to America. George's first official presidential act was to install a corporate military government to replace the expected constitutional civilian government, which just happens to be the same one that exists to date. President Washington's military government is intentionally hidden in plain sight, which is evidenced by the military terms utilized to describe those designated offices, e.g. Commander-in-Chief, Attorney General, Auditor General, Secretary General, Postmaster General, Surgeon General, etc. Every office is supervised by a military general. Sometimes the best hiding place is one in plain sight. Edgar Allan Poe. President Washington's actions were treasonous to be certain, and he was fully supported by the first elected members of the Continental Congress, which amounts to subordination of treason and conspiracy. The organic constitution would have bound the hands of the President and Congress, and so they all decided that it had to be eliminated or circumvented. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Acton, 1887 George also established the first Masonic lodge in America with the intent of mustering the support of the influential colonial families to declare him America's king, and to his chagrin his plan failed miserably because he could not secure the influence or support required. These influential people were already faithful to the King George and the new Rothschild royal family, and Washington is very lucky that he wasn't assassinated. On an historic note, George Washington is indirectly descended from William, the Prince of Orange, an Illuminati high priest and thus a relation to the Rothschild royal family. Ironically, 36 every president of the United States has been directly or indirectly related to this same royal bloodline ever since. Even our current president is connected through his mother's side of the family. Note, throughout my early years as an American, I was taught in public school and convinced that anyone can become president and that the American public made that choice. Evidence now reveals that our choices were pre-selected for us and that every high-ranking candidate, either Democrat or Republican, had to be a part of the elite class and had to agree to adhere to the whims and demands of the high contracting powers who control and run approximately 71 of the 267 countries of the world via the United Nations and now are commonly referred to as the criminal cabal. Their board of directors operate on American soil under the protection of a European corporation titled Lumi Corp. All of these people are all of the same royal bloodline and form the nucleus of the secret society and criminal cabal known as the Illuminati. We Americans have been indoctrinated through expert programming, conditioning, prejudice and patriotism, to treat information like this as being ridiculous, absurd and untrue. Time to grow up, America. Look around you and look at your lives. They have eliminated the family farms and local stores, placed us into cities, gave our industry a way to break the unions, issued valueless currency and stole our gold and silver, raised taxes and stole their paper currency back, involved us in staged wars, began a mass foreclosure of American homes and poisoned our air and public water. How long can you continue to believe in their complex fairy tales? George Washington and the Continental Congress all feared that their treasonous conduct would become public knowledge and their reprisal swift and certain, so they concealed these facts by hiring authors to write and publish a different account of historical facts. Note, these facts and all post-events will continue to be altered by the high contracting powers, which will eventually be force-fed to all Americans through control vehicles like the media, Hollywood, and public or parochial schools. Abraham Lincoln, 37 being the absolute liberal that he was, President Abraham Lincoln, attempted to do everything within his power to avoid a civil war. The published version of American history doesn't reflect the fact that Lincoln had offered to compromise his stand on slavery, e.g. his proposal was that 1/7 of the slave population would be freed each year during the following 7 years. There were forces unknown to him who were instigating a civil war and who were ready to blame Lincoln and the slave question. These forces also convinced the Southern states to secede from the Union, which was certain to destroy the foundation of the American government, and so a civil war was imminent. The secession of the Southern states from the Union technically destroyed the United States Congress because a quorum could never be convened, so all acts by the Congress during the Civil War were never lawful. Note, this last statement is based upon the presumption that anything Congress did before that timeline was somehow lawful. Lincoln attempted to cure this problem of the absence of a quorum by declaring that America was at war. He supported his actions based upon the War Powers Clause found within the unenforceable, organic Constitution of the United States of America. To his credit, Lincoln was the first president who intended to sever the European Royal and Rothschild factions' control over the United States, which, like President John Kennedy, resulted in both of their deaths. The high contracting powers, European royal and elite, preferred a war to a peace because war stimulated commerce and they all stood in a position to profit from every service generated by and within commerce, especially during a war. While the war carried on, it would act as a diversion to their subterfuge and their Babylonian slave control techniques. At the start of the Civil War, Lincoln attempted to secure financing for the North from the Central Bank of America, named the United States Bank, which belonged to the Rothschild banking empire. The central bank demanded a high interest, a lien on the government treasury, and repayment of the loan in gold. Lincoln 38 was so outraged by these terms and the lack of sentiment and patriotism that he promised when the war was over, his first act will be to drive the central bank out of America, and the verbiage used in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address would redefine his desire and intent to break the corrupt ties of the European royal and elite that controlled and bound America. It was his stated threat about the central bank and his Gettysburg Address that caused Lincoln's assassination and not his stand on slavery. Threats leveled against America's banks will continue to be the impetus for many future murders. During the American Civil War, the Confiscation Act of 1861 was adopted. This was an act between the military governments representing the North and the South and was defined by those governmental bodies to be the rules of engagement and military protocol concerning how those governments and their military will deal with American citizens during time of war. The words time of war will become a key in years to come with the passage of the Lieber Code and the Trading with the Enemy Act. The Confiscation Act specified that anyone who fought against the government of the North would automatically lose his property, but non-combatants who had suffered such property loss or confiscation would subsequently be entitled to lawful compensation. A legal ruse to be certain. Note regarding the Confiscation Act, how do you prove a negative, that you are a non-combatant or not guilty of a crime, and why should anyone have to, especially when it is physically impossible? This reminds me of the Catholic Inquisition and the Salem witch trials. Everyone accused of witchery was burned at the stake or drowned because no one could prove that they were not a witch. In 1863, the Lieber Code was adopted, as well as General Order No. 100, signed by President Abraham Lincoln. This code is similar in nature to the Confiscation Act and the Geneva Convention, to be discussed next, and better defined how Union soldiers shall conduct themselves in time of war, and specified that any military officer who violated this code shall be treated as a belligerent. This became another key word then and in the future, because a belligerent shall come to be treated as a combatant, and as such, 39, subject to the Confiscation Act and the loss of his liberty and all he owns. This is exactly what happens to defendants in America's courts of justice, or rather America's military courts. In 1864, the Virginia Colony, America's corporate military government, under the guise of the United States of America, entered into an international treaty titled the Geneva Convention. International treaties are recognized by all of the world's governments and therefore carry more force and effect in law than any constitution or individual contracts called statutes. The crux of this particular international treaty specifically prohibited any and all military intervention and or the operation of any military courts of justice over the civilian population of any conquered nation. By entering into this treaty as the United States of America, the treaty became null and void due to fraud, because America was actually operating under the corporation titled the Virginia Colony. Factually, Americans are a conquered people, conquered by the European royal and elite and by their own federal and state governments, with the stroke of a pen and the expert use of legalese, deception, patriotism, propaganda, fear, and intimidation. Hence, the proof of the old phrase coined by Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton, in his 1839 play about a papal conspiracy, "Beneath the rule of men entirely great, the pen is mightier than the sword." Lincoln's declaration of war under the War Powers Clause of Article 1, Clause 8 of the Constitution has yearly and secretly been renewed by Congress and all past presidents, but for a different reason. Their renewed declaration of war specifies that the private corporate U.S. government is at war with America and its people, and defines the American public as the enemy of the state. Now you know why the President and Congress continue to screw us over and constantly lie to the American public. Note: the mention of the Constitution by the corporate government is only done to appease the ear of the American people. The Congress, judges, and bar lawyers laugh at Americans who claim protections under the Constitution, and they label them constitutionalists. Still, the politicians and the media continue to pacify us by telling the American public that we are a free nation and a nation of laws, protected by a Constitution. 40. It sounds safe and comforting, and that is what the bulk of society really cares about, being safe and comfortable, because we equate our safety and pleasure with freedom. In December 2011, Congress repealed the Bill of Rights, and in March 2012, repealed the First Amendment and ordered a media blackout of both events. So how safe do you feel now? On or about December 6, 1865, the Congress of the Virginia Colony, America's corporate military government, secretly rewrote the Organic Constitution of the United States of America, twice in the same year, which disposed of the original 13th Amendment and then replaced the 13th by moving the 14th down to the 13th position. The original 13th Amendment prohibited lawyers from ever holding a seat in government, and now 98% of all government offices and 100% of all judges of the courts of record are held by lawyers. 7 makes you think, doesn't it? The 14th Amendment followed on the heels of the Emancipation Proclamation, which was supposed to free the slaves and define all of our individual rights, which turned out to be another canard. The 14th Amendment did just the opposite, which will be explained as you read on. In the next rewrite of the Constitution, the 15th, 16th and 17th Amendments were added without a constitutional convention or public vote and were actually rejected by every state government of the Republic. However, the Secretary of the Congress ignored the rejection letters and reported to Congress and the media that these amendments had been ratified by a sufficient number of states. These amendments were intended to give the federal government the authority to tax us into poverty, and they use those amendments with great proficiency. Future arguments before the Supreme Court resulted in the High Court declaring that the legality of these amendments was a political issue and not a judicial one, and they subsequently refused to rule on them. Note, the Secretary of the Congress got away with this deception because the Constitution was never intended for America from the start. The colonists were functional illiterates and many a wool was pulled over their eyes, and unfortunately the same strategy. 7. Judge Dale provided more details regarding the missing 13th Amendment in the add-on article on page 118. 41 continues to be used against us today, to keep all Americans functional but illiterate. Despite the fact that these secret rewrites were contrary to any public vote or law, Congress finally adopted the rewritten Constitution in Washington, D.C., which became the proprietary law for the District of Columbia. Proprietary law carries with it the same force and effect as a city ordinance, and since the District of Columbia is not a recognized state, this ordinance was only enforceable against the residents of Washington, D.C., also known as federal foreign citizens, United States citizens, and 14th Amendment citizens. These works of art were created by the 14th Amendment with the future intent to entrap us all. The 13th, 14th and 15th Amendments were amendments to the Reconstruction Act, and with the passage of the Reconstruction Act, these works of art forced all state governments and state officials into the District of Columbia as extensions of the corporate federal government. This underlying deception created another set of duplicitous governments, which pose as state governments, which are actually federal, with state officials that are actually federal officials. The residents of Washington, D.C. are actually federal foreign citizens because Washington, D.C. is not a state and therefore is alien to the American Republic. Prior to this date, Americans residing within the states were referred to as sovereign citizens of the Republic. The power of the word sovereign comes from the Declaration of Independence and God. The corporate state government fears the sovereign citizen because corporations and politicians have no power over the source of law, and sovereigns are the source of all man-made laws. Despite the fact that we are never provided with the opportunity to vote on the passage of any of the government's planned statutes, which were designed purely to drive and control us. Statutes are written and passed by the Congress as though they are kings in the Kingdom of America. As an elector, is that what you voted for at every national election? A corporation is a dead legal fiction. Corporations cannot walk, talk or make decisions. They are defined by a piece of paper in a safe somewhere called a charter. They have no soul to save or body to incarcerate. 42 Contrary to popular opinion, the 14th Amendment did not free anyone but rather enslaved everyone, except for a list of 300 influential families who were granted immunity from the 14th Amendment and can be found in the Congressional Record of 1865, which gave them diplomatic immunity. The 14th Amendment did not initially make everyone a 14th Amendment citizen nor grant any special rights or freedoms, e.g. the Bill of Rights. What it succeeded in doing was to make all public officers and people in residence within the District of Columbia, a 14th Amendment citizen a United States citizen and federal foreign citizen and provided for a bounty, enforceable against them for the non-payment of the public debt, which was later changed or coined by Congress as the national debt. The public debt or national debt belongs to a private corporation named the Federal Reserve. This bounty could not lawfully be enforced against anyone else because everyone residing within the states was still a sovereign American citizen of the Republic. The word sovereign is derived from the law of kings, meaning that the source of law is derived from the king and therefore the force of law can never be enforced against its source. As sovereign citizens of the Republic, we are the king and source of law and therefore the force of law cannot be enforced against us, except by us and not by any government. If there isn't some truth in what I write, why would the federal government exercise such pains to facilitate this complex political conundrum and fraud? This also explains why every law is civil, even the ones defined as criminal are actually civil. Civil contracts can be enforced against everyone including the king. By the third constitutional rewrite, we all unknowingly became a 14th Amendment citizen by our consent and became the collateral property of the corporate United States government, which once again is the King and Queen of England, the Vatican, and the Sabaudon/Rothschild royal family faction. Our lives, our destiny, our children, our credit, our labor, our freedom, and all we perceive to own, would be and has since been leveraged against the unlimited spending practices of that body politic. Our money was once backed by gold and after 1933 it read, backed by the good faith and credit of the American people. And now it promises 43 absolutely nothing because now it is all just fiat money or counterfeit, which has no ascertainable value. Note, every time you complete a government form or tax return, you are asked to check a box indicating that you are a United States citizen, meaning a 14th Amendment citizen, under penalty of perjury. You should be checking the box that reads, Alien of the United States instead because we are not residents of Washington, D.C., or the territory of Puerto Rico, Guam or Samoa. Unless employed by the government, we all are alien to the federal government and not their corporate property. Again, this is done to entrap us into reaffirming our consent that we are their corporate property and subordinate to the parent corporation, federal government, and if you try to recant that admission, you are guilty of perjury. Ingenious. Isn't it? Next came the Reconstruction Act of 1868, which is misleading because it actually dealt with reconstructing the order of governmental power and redefined the military's purpose and authority within the Virginia Company, fraudulently being represented as the United States of America. This remains in full force and effect today despite the fact that President Andrew Jackson had vetoed it. Presidential vetoes can be defeated by a two-thirds majority vote by Congress and this one subsequently was defeated. E.g. as a result of this act, the power and authority of the military supersedes all power or authority of all state, county and city governments, which are now a part of the federal government and all law enforcement personnel is subordinate to the president and the generals in charge of the federal government and therefore the power and authority of the federal government becomes an absolute by this act. All this means is that the government now has the right to tell you how to live your life whereas, before this act, we controlled the government. Note, this explains how an FBI agent can take an investigation away from a local police department. All states and state officials are sub-federal and are subordinate to the federal government when we at one time used to control the state and federal government as a republic. Any and all who refuse, will be treated as belligerents and subject to the Confiscation Act. Most people who have a local, county or state job do not realize that they are all 44 federal employees pursuant to the Reconstruction Act and the 13th, 14th and 15th Amendments. The bankruptcy of America, 1933 and the introduction of a new legal system on March 9, 1933, House Joint Resolution No. 192-10 by the 73rd Congress, was voted into law, which is the Emergency Banking Act. This act declared the Treasury of the United States bankrupt, which is an impossible feat since the U.S. Treasury was secretly closed by the Congress 12 years earlier in 1921. The Emergency Banking Act succeeded in abrogating America's gold standard and hypothecated all property found within the United States to the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank. All sovereign American citizens residing within the Republic of States suddenly and falsely were expatriated from their sovereign American status, without their knowledge or consent, and their labor, souls, children, property, sweat equity, and credit became the financial collateral for the public debt, which had then been converted into a public trust, which had been scripted after the ancient Roman trusts. 9. Script money or negotiable debt instruments was issued by a private corporation, which is owned by a group of Sabbatean European Jewish bankers and which is known to everybody as the Federal Reserve System. These promissory notes were called Federal Reserve Notes and are future treatment by the U.S. 9. This information was confirmed by Rep. James Traficant, Ohio, on the floor of Congress. C. Congressional Record, March 1993, anticorruptionsociety.com. Source documents 45 Government was to be redefined under USC United States Code Title 50, the Trading with the Enemy Act, in which American citizens are defined as an enemy of their government, and this is the reason why Lincoln's declaration of war is renewed yearly by Congress and the President. In the same year, President Roosevelt closed the Virginia Colony Corporation and opened a new government corporation called the United States, Inc. The Federal Reserve Act was designed and written by a German national who was repatriated into the United States in 1903, through Ellis Island of New York. His name was Paul Warburg, and who was a carbon copy of Alexander, Levine, Hamilton. Mr. Warburg was a Sabbatean German Jewish banker and CFO of the Rothschild banking empire. Mr. Warburg's assignment was to craft a piece of legislation designed to control the finances of the United States Corporation from Europe. The Federal Reserve Act is approximately 1,500 pages and places the currency and finance for the United States Corporation under a private corporation called the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is owned lock, stock and barrel, by the Sabbatean/Rothschild banking empire and not by the people or the corporate government of the United States. The Great Depression of 1929, like so many other catastrophes before and after this date, was actually a staged event, concocted by the Sabbatean/Rothschild and Rockefeller banking empires, the Queen and British Parliament, the U.S. President and Congress, the Vatican and numerous elite families to steal America's gold and silver reserves and replace it with negotiable debt instruments or script money. Their theft was ingenious, and by allowing the public to fall on hard times, the public soon began to demand that the government fix the problem by any means necessary. This was like self-mutilation being repaired with a band-aid. Note, while everyone struggled in this country to survive, President Roosevelt and the Congress were making interest-bearing loans to foreign governments using the very money they publicly swore did not exist. Germany used that money to enlarge their war chest. The American public, however, was so self-indulged about their own personal fate that they never considered or asked how it was possible that all of the above government individuals never personally lost a dime during the Great Depression, and how they all 46 continued to enjoy their family estates and personal wealth. Remember the term, functional illiterates. Need I say more? We all have been trained to believe that someone not born on American soil is an alien, however we forget to consider that the Declaration of Independence was written completely by aliens and not one adult colonist or founding father was born on American soil. The immigration laws of the United States are contrary to the Declaration of Independence, and the biggest terrorist on the planet is now the United States government. This fact will be further discussed later on. Following the 1933 bankruptcy, most Americans were not aware that H.R. 1491 or H.R. 4960 had been secretly passed, wherein the U.S. Congress actually relinquished our right to have or accumulate gold and silver. The Congress eventually repealed part of this legislation to accommodate jewelers, but all Americans are still prohibited from having or accumulating solid gold and silver. Hence, our coins are no longer solid gold or silver, but are tin and nickel-plated, carbon-filled coins. Pennies are tin and copper-plated carbon-filled coins. These acts also established the requirement of licensing, and then with the enactment of the Trading with the Enemy Act, under War and National Defense, the Confiscation Act, the Reconstruction Act and the Labor Code were all tied together to create the secret fascist government of the United States. Note, the word license is defined in all modern law dictionaries as a permit to do something unlawful. Now think about that and consider all the licenses you currently hold. Those licenses are civil contracts that have been issued to you by the government only so that you may do something lawful but rather unlawful. E.g., when two people apply for a marriage license, the two of you enter into a binding contract, and by applying for a license to marry, you now have voluntarily included the state as a third party to your marriage. If things don't work out in that marriage, the state is first to be satisfied. E.g., your right to travel is an unalienable right defined by the Declaration of Independence and not a privilege, and yet the government demands that you apply for a driver's license. Google, right to travel, and read the millions of old court rulings that cite our right to travel without a license. The courts now refuse to 47 honor those old precedents of law since 1938 because of a Supreme Court case titled Erie Railroad v. Tompkins, 304 U.S. 64. 1938. Mr. Tompkins attempted to walk along a set of railroad tracks when he was struck by an appendage fastened to a mail train, and he subsequently sued, claiming negligence and damages on the part of the railroad. What Tompkins didn't know was that the railroads were in partnership with the corporate United States government, and so to protect the government, the Supreme Court ruled that, absent a ticket or license, Tompkins was trespassing on railroad property and therefore he was barred from any relief. This ruling wiped the slate clean by eliminating all previous court precedents that occurred prior to the year 1938 concerning our unalienable right to travel, and opened a floodgate for new state and federal government controls such as the state vehicle codes and the requirement for licensing of everything and anything. Prior to 1933, we all were proud and peaceful sovereign inhabitants of America. The Trading with the Enemy Act, the Confiscation Act, and the Labor Code obligated the military government to peacefully interact with American citizens and prohibited them from provoking us or to act belligerently toward us, or they forfeit their ability to profit and loot or to securitize our property, equity, and credit being held in a public trust. When we voluntarily or involuntarily entered their military courts of justice, one will frequently hear the prosecutor or defense lawyer argue that your comment or actions are a belligerent response or you are being combative. Keywords to inform you that you or someone else is about to be fleeced. Lawyers will even attempt to provoke you or your witnesses' anger in the court, just so you or they behave belligerently toward them, and this is why they do that. Under Regulation 840-10 of the Military Code and sections of the Administrative Procedures Act, and the presence of that military, gold-fringed, flag on display in the courtroom, instantly creates a state of emergency, meaning that the moment a police officer stopped you in the exercise of your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the police officer became a belligerent. He is armed and you're not. He displays a military rank and you're a civilian, and he has now delivered you into a military court of justice 48 with the intent to pillage and plunder within the admiralty jurisdiction of that military court, which is also known as the law of prize and captured property, as defined under Title 10, Sections 7651-7681 of the Code of Military Justice, March 25, 1862. Gold-fringed flag displayed in courtrooms. As mentioned before, the Reconstruction Act included and changed all state officials into having federal foreign standing. The 14th Amendment deliberately forced and kept them there, and Section 2 of the Labor Code instructs that a victorious army seizes all money and movable property and holds it in trust, and this is exactly what the corporate United States government and state governments did and continue to do, because they now perceive themselves to be a victorious army. The corporate Congress, the corporate military government, and their corporate military courts of justice, however, discovered that they could not gain access to those public trusts deposited into the Federal Reserve System, which they had created using our birth registration forms, Social Security registration forms, licenses, personal property, deeds, promissory notes, equity, and credit, without including our individual persons into the bankruptcy of the United States Treasury of 1933. So they cleverly denied our personal sovereignty and converted our persons into an appellation, which is a corporate fiction or strawman, and identified us by writing our birth names all in capital letters. All of our licenses and documents now reflect this appellation. Note, of course they cannot lawfully do this because we are a sovereign people and they are a corporation, and under the Confiscation Act, they have violated their own rules of engagement and military protocol, but do they care? Not anymore. The all caps name can be researched in every state code under corporations, e.g. see the Texas Administrative Code, for example, under corporations, chapter 79.31, subtitled, entities. Also the 49 all caps name is specified in the United States Government Style Manual under the section titled Identifying Corporations. These public trusts are not a new concept. The concept and strategy was copied from the ancient Roman Empire and their use of Roman trusts. The ancient Roman trusts declared that everyone had died after Rome was burned, which was a staged event, and until those Roman citizens served notice upon the Roman Senate that they were in fact alive and capable of managing their own estates, all were presumed dead, and the Roman Senate became the trustee over every estate and used them as they deemed appropriate. Note, you can buy your freedom for a price of $600,000 through the Department of State, which is the cost of procuring American diplomatic immunity pursuant to international law. In all other countries, this same immunity can be purchased for $95,000, which is honored in 90 of the 267 world countries with the exception of the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Isn't that curious? My point here is that everything is a game, and for enough money, anyone can play and secure their freedom from criminal law, civil lawsuits, taxes, and passports, because everything in this world is about commerce. In 1933, this corporate government enticed Americans to voluntarily register for birth certificates, social security, driver's licenses, voter registration, etc., and enticed us with government benefits to do so. Years later, they obligated Americans to register for all of these documents except for voter registration. These so-called government benefits were no bargain because they belonged to all of us to begin with, and over time the largest benefits have been watered down. What most Americans don't realize is that no corporation can operate or fund itself. Corporations require human beings and their credit and sweat equity to finance and operate them. Therefore, everything that the government claims to own actually belongs to we the public and not them. Everything they have been doing is one gigantic fraud, and all of it at our expense. As previously mentioned, these registration programs were instituted so that the Federal Reserve Banks and the corporate 50 military courts of justice could securitize and monetize the public trust accounts. Each birth certificate and social security card was eventually converted into a trust account and became a government security, like company stocks and bonds, and is marketed as a mutual fund. If you own a piece of a mutual fund investment, you are actually hedging your money against human collateral. Every bond or international security is assigned a CUSIP number, and if you know how to use their formula or have a close friend who is a stockbroker, you or he can convert the numbers and letters found on your social security card into its CUSIP number. Armed with those CUSIP numbers, anyone can look up their mutual funds that your life is being collectively marketed under. Your birth certificate number is handled the same way. Our forced registration of birth actually made us the personal property of the state. Each of us unknowingly gave our children away to the government of the state where they were born when we registered them for a government-issued birth certificate, which is how the state government controls child custody. Our children are now their collective property, and we are permitted to keep and raise them, providing that we behave ourselves and comply with their corporate laws and regulations. The state obligates us to pay for our children, and they generally object to pay for anything unless we become dead or destitute. It is also the birth certificate that provides the police with the authority to break and enter any house under suspicion of abuse, but now the Patriot Act covers all other situations. The fee simple deed gave the state your home and the right to tax you into poverty as a tenant, and the Patriot Act eliminated the need for search warrants. You are no longer the king of your castle, which was guaranteed by the allodial deed, because you no longer own a castle. Your personal lawyer set that one up too and received a large, one-time secret kickback from the state government on your first tax bill, in addition to the fees you paid to him to represent your best interests. Devious people, aren't they? 51. When our deeds were allodial, no one could trespass on our property, not even the government. No one could tax your property, and no bank could foreclose on your property, but there again, no bank would ever loan you money against your property either. we were the kings and sovereign rulers of our land and homes. Do you now see how the government has been chipping away at your basic rights and freedoms? 52 Part 3 U.S. Presidents